Show me the money.
This is the Money Web Be a Better Investor podcast, picking the brains of professional investors on their investment strategies, successes, and mistakes. Your host, Rake Fanica.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Be a Better Investor podcast. My name is Rake van Niekerk. In this podcast series, I speak to leading professional investors about their investment journeys. We look at their first investments and how their investment strategies have changed over the years. And we also look at their personal portfolios to see whether they practice what they preach. And the idea is to identify a few golden nuggets of wisdom to help amateur retail investors to become better investors. My guest today is Sumesh Chetty. He is currently a portfolio manager at 91. He is an actuary and he has been in the investment business for over two decades. Sumesh, thank you so much for your time. First of all, tell us a bit about your background and where did you grow up and what career did you dream of when you were young?
Thank you so much for having me here today, Rick. So I grew up in Durban. And investments was the furthest thing from my thought process. I remember wanting to get into some sort of kind of art field, either graphic design or fine art. That's what I was really, really excited about. And my parents were super supportive. You know, they believed in education, but they really believed in following your passion. And I think it was only much later on, I think it was in matric, actually, when I started thinking, well, how am I actually going to support myself? I studied art history at school. And the more you read about famous artists, the more you realize that most of them died starving artists, at least way back in the day. And I just thought, you know, I can't be this burden to my parents for 10, 20, 30 years, whatever it may be. And I actually needed to go into some sort of profession and make a little bit of cash. And then maybe, you know, art's kind of the side project thing. And, you know, at the time, growing up in an Indian community, all the rage was send your kids to do medicine. And my parents were not keen on that at all. They were like, listen, it's the furthest thing from what you want to do. And at the time, I couldn't stand the sight of blood. So that wasn't going to work out either. And then one of my closest friends at school was going to study actuarial science. And I had no idea what this was. And he starts telling me about it. And it's like impossible to qualify. And it was in financial services. And it seemed like you could earn a good living. And I was like, you know, how hard could it be? Let me come try this with you. It's probably like a good job afterwards. I'll figure it out. That's what got me into actuarial science at Varsity. And it wasn't what I expected at all. It was crazy difficult. But what was great about actuarial science is it also exposed me to investments for the first time, you know, be it the Investors Club at UCT or the actual investment component of the degree. So that was really exciting. And after I was exposed, the bug had bitten. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I do for the rest of my life after I've qualified.
You referred to the investment club at UCT. Tell us about that and why you found it valuable.
It was exciting more than valuable. You know, I didn't know what I was doing when we joined. We didn't talk about investments in my household. But what it did do is it exposed us to a lot of company CEOs. I remember Tom Boardman was the first company CEO I met. I'm speaking to the audience at Investors Club. And it was just such a fascinating conversation to hear his story and then to think about it in terms of the actual stocks that you could buy. And then, you know, we'd have this share trading game as well. And it was just, you know, get in there, figure out what looks interesting, what doesn't look interesting. And I had no idea how it worked at all. And all I kind of understood at the time was, look, you want maximum reward for the risk. And the great thing at the time was you weren't taking any risk because you weren't playing with real money. And so risk reward lesson I learned very quickly, because it was a case of buy the riskiest investment at the time. This is not my investment philosophy, but at the time it was buy the riskiest investment and see how you do. And that paid off. But, you know, I'm at least happy to say as I progressed through Varsity, at least there were more important lessons that I picked up when it came to investing. But Investors Club at UCT was a fantastic starting ground for actually exposing you to this.
Now, I think it's a good idea for young individuals who would like to enter the investment world is to form an investment club and talk about investments and talk to professional or experienced investors to get some guidance. But what was the very first investment you made with money you have earned?
So I couldn't do the first investment, but I'm going to tell you about it anyway. And then I'll tell you what the actual first investment was. So it was at the back end of varsity, so late 90s, and the Russian debt crisis had just happened. So you had the Asian debt crisis, and then you had the Russian debt crisis. And South African government bond yields blew up to about 20%. And we were the fourth year investment class. We were doing a lot of work on bonds at the time. And that 20% yield for 10 years or longer seemed incredibly attractive to me. And I think I had managed to save a whole 1,000 Rand at the time. So this is like 1998. And I was so excited. I was like, I'm going to buy a government bond and lock into this fantastic interest rate. I remember getting some advice from friends, finding out who their father's brokers were, whatever the case was. And I started calling around. And people were laughing me off phone calls. Because what I didn't realize then was it wasn't like a unit trust. It wasn't divisible. It wasn't like buying one share. That you had to buy them in tranches of 1 million, the face value of 1 million. Obviously, it would cost a bit less because it was on 20% yield. But let's say it was still somewhere between 600,000 and 700,000 Rand per individual bond. So that was the first attempt. I was so bleak that I couldn't do it. And then a couple of years passed. I think it was another 2 years when I started working at Swiss Re. And what was fantastic about Swiss Re is both my boss and my colleagues in the actuarial team were all very focused on markets. They loved markets with a passion. They were always talking about markets. It was my boss who actually introduced me to my first unit trust investment as well. And the investment I made then, because I managed to save a little more money, I made an investment on the basis of what I thought was value investing at the time. You know, Warren Buffett's one of the first investment names that I think a young investor picks up on, or at least used to pick up on. And I bought FedShore. And I got very attracted to FedShore because during varsity, I had done VAC work at Norwich Life. You know, I'd really gotten a feel for, you know, actuarial valuations. You got to apply what you learned at varsity. And then I think Norwich had listed, which was very exciting. And then FedShore bought Norwich. And all of a sudden, the dividend yield in FedShore had started climbing. And I think it was up at a 5 or 6% at the time. And it looked so attractive. And I said, fantastic. Buy FedShore. You understand the business. You'll get reasonable growth out of this business, but you're going to get this great dividend yield. So it starts by generating income. I put, I think, the 5,000 Rand into FedShore, and the dividend climbed, and it climbed, and it kept climbing. And then, of course, there was that announcement about inappropriate management of or separation of shareholder and policyholder funds. FedShore got taken out by Investec, and I still thought, okay, not too bad, at least to get Investec shares. And then every time there was a news release, it was Investec kept revaluing FedShore down. So however many shares they originally proposed to take out FedShore, I mean, I was left with a fraction afterwards. So it was an absolute disaster of a first investment. But, you know, the one thing it taught me was you can't count on those dividend yields. In fact, when that dividend yield is way above average, you should actually tend to view that with suspicion.
You see, one of the biggest challenges for many investors is to know when to get out. Because most investment philosophies, such as the philosophies of Warren Buffett, is buy something you believe offers value and then forget about it. Don't ever sell it. And that is not always the case. People make poor decisions, investment decisions, and then they need to limit the losses. And I haven't heard really a good theory of how you should go about identifying a poor performing investment and then to get out before you hit rock bottom and to ensure that that decision is not an emotional one.
Yeah, 100%. It's hard because so many investors actually advocate doubling down on a position. You know, so you're throwing more and more money at a losing position with the expectation that there's going to be some kind of mean reversion. Everything's going to go right to the business. But your starting point actually has to be you're investing in the right kind of business. Like you take the FedShore example. My mistake was I invested in a black box business. You know, insurers are notoriously black boxes. You really have to know what's going on in an insurance business. And at that age, I didn't have a clue. So, you know, when you think about investments, you really should be going, hold on, what is this fundamentally? What is this business doing? There are things you should be able to hang your hat on, the industry it's operating in, you know, competitive advantages. You've got to make sure that this business is growing. There's got to be economic value creation. And you can measure that easily, right? I like looking at return on invested capital versus weighted average cost of capital. But the most fundamental thing, and this is where it becomes hard with insurers, is you've got to watch cash flow. You talk to any small business owner, someone who owns a cafe, cash flow. Cash is king. When the cash flow dries up, when the cash flow goes negative, that business is in trouble. And too often, I think there are investors who aren't watching that cash flow closely enough. Because if you do have growth, if you've got that cash flow, you know, when there are these exogenous events that impact a company, you know, it's down 30, 40, 50%, you can buy more. But when it's intrinsic or it's embedded in the company, something's gone wrong in that business and they can't recover from it, you know, you can often identify the things that you missed up front.
Let's talk about your investment philosophy and how it has developed over the years. So let's start off with, if you could go back to Sumesh, the 21, 22-year-old, where you started to enter the investment market, what advice would you give yourself if you could?
I think I would say, however much you were reading back then, you weren't reading enough. You've got to read widely, very, very widely. And, you know, it's not just about reading about the great investors or investment strategies or following what South African investment managers or global investment managers are doing. It's also reading in other disciplines. You know, you hear this concept of mental models or trying to figure out how the world works. I'd also say, you know, people should read more history, and it doesn't necessarily have to relate to financial markets, because, you know, the markets don't repeat, but they rhyme, because human nature is relatively unchanged through time. I think the other thing that's important is I would have been a lot harder. I mean, if I'm giving myself this advice, I would have been a lot harder on myself about knowing what I knew and what I didn't know, and also what you can't possibly know, no matter how much work you put in. It's so important to realize that more often than not, you're making decisions with imperfect information. And then I think it's also your temperament. You've got to understand who you are. You've got to figure out who you are, what level of risk you're willing to tolerate, because you've got to be able to sleep at night. You know, there are some people who are incredibly risk-seeking and they can go to bed and not stress about that. But if you're someone who can't do that, you've got to think hard about what sort of investments you want in your portfolio. And then I think most importantly, because you hear these stats, like if you want to be a crazy successful investor, you're only going to be right 60% of the time. You're going to be wrong 40% of the time. Average investors, probably under 50% right. So you're going to make mistakes. You've got to be comfortable with making those mistakes. The one thing about investments is it so often proves you wrong. So if you're someone who has to be right all the time, this is not going to work for you. But in keeping with that, you should figure out a process that works for you and stick to it, even when it's going to go wrong. You're going to make mistakes, right? They're going to be errors of commission, but you don't want to compound those errors. So if you don't have a process, you are going to compound those errors. So it comes back to what you were saying up front. You know, there's so many investors who don't cut their losses. Part of your process might be saying, here's the total loss that I can tolerate. Or even, you know, if I have 20 stocks in my portfolio, I need 19 to do X and I can tolerate that one doing Y. Whatever that process is, there is no right or wrong process. There's only a process that works for you and hopefully, you know, produces the right results.
Let's talk about your personal investments. What is your current approach? And can you maybe discuss a few of the investments within your portfolio?
Yeah, of course. So 100% aligned to what I'm doing professionally. So I work in the quality capability. You know, I've already spoken about or mentioned competitive advantages, revenue growth, cash flow, ROIC versus WACC, pricing power ultimately. And in my personal portfolio, I think exactly the same way. So when I started and I got FedSure wrong, you know, I stood back because I wasn't working in investments then. I was working in an insurance company. And when I moved into investments, you know, post FedSure, I basically just said, okay, let me go into unit trust for now while I develop more capital, build a little more capital. And it's only once I'd bedded down that philosophy, and that philosophy bedding down really happened when I got to 91, because up until that point, I thought I was a pure value investor, and coming to 91, you know, made me realize I was actually a quality investor. And so when that puzzle piece came together for me, only then did I become comfortable investing in a personal account as well, or investing directly into stocks. So one of the rules that I have personally is if it's not held for investors, I won't hold it for myself. So the best ideas go to our investors first, and then I'm happy to hold it for myself as well. Because we run multi-asset funds, you know, personal risk tolerance can be higher than the funds that you're managing. And then effectively, if you look at our funds, the stocks that we hold are the stocks that I'll hold in my personal capacity. So, you know, when you think about it, British American Tobacco, is held in the portfolio, Discovery is held in the portfolio, Capitec, FirstRand, Tencent, and on and on and on.
It's those big so-called blue chip companies, but it's always interesting for me when a South African investor buys directly into Tencent, for example, as opposed to through Prosus and Naspers here in South Africa. Why did you do that?
Well, when I looked at Naspers, and sorry, I've held Tencent for a number of years now, what concerned me about Naspers was the ability of Naspers to generate meaningful return on invested capital on the non-Tencent assets. And what attracted me to Tencent more so than the rest of the rump in Naspers was the fact that this was a business that was actually dominant in an area it was playing in. Whereas if you looked at what Naspers was trying to do in the classified verticals in food delivery, it was an incredibly competitive space. And it wasn't clear in those days that Naspers themselves or each of the underlying companies would be the winner. You know, if you look at the results that Naspers have reported most recently, or Prosus for that matter, you know, they've only just started breaking even on the total food delivery component. So they're still a while out, I think, from proving themselves. They're still finding their feet in terms of being operational or investment. But Tencent was actually a proven business model. They're going through some problems now, of course, given the anti-China sentiment or investors running from China. But Tencent, to me at least, looked far more attractive than Naspers. And it was a way of investing money that you were slowly, slowly taking out of the country.
Now, for the two questions most people wait for, and the first one is, you know, what is the worst investment you have ever made? I think you've discussed Fetcher, which was a bit of a disaster, but was that the worst one you've ever made?
Yeah, that was the worst. It wouldn't be the worst in terms of Rand losses, because I would have only had about 5,000 Rand to put into Fedshaw. But I think Fedshaw probably represented like a 75% loss for me. So yeah, that would be the worst investment ever. Absolute worst investment ever.
Now let's be positive. What has been the best one you have made, the one you are the most proud of?
Capitec. And I was late to the party on Capitec, both personally and obviously in the portfolios. You know, I was very skeptical about unsecured lending, especially given, say, the distribution of wealth in South Africa.
When did you get in?
2014, maybe 2015. So it's very, very recent. Well, I mean, I know some people think 10 years is a very, very long time. But, you know, typically when I think about markets, I'm thinking 5-10 years and much longer. You know, so it would have already been, let's say it would have felt expensive when I bought it. But where I got really lucky about Capitec, and it comes back to your point, your first point about cutting losses or understanding whether you should be investing more. There were two fantastic opportunities following that initial investment. So I didn't put a lot in. I was like, okay, there are going to be better opportunities. Like, you know, wait for a market crash, wait for people to get worried about Capitec. I put some in and I said, okay, you'll buy more later. And there were two opportunities that came along where I was very, very lucky. And the first was, do you remember after the Steinhoff incident, or I shouldn't call it the incident, Viceroy also published a report on Capitec, and the market got a massive fright. Everyone started running, and we spoke about it a lot internally. And fundamentally, it didn't seem like there was anything wrong with the business. So we actually used that opportunity, and I also personally used that opportunity to top up. So that was fantastic. And then obviously we had the COVID crisis, and I bought more Capitec in the COVID crisis personally. But in addition to that, the directors of Capitec had option structures that had to be rolled. And there was a tremendous amount of selling in the market because of this, the hedging the banks were doing, the rolling of these option structures. And Capitec cratered to, I think, like 680, 690 Rand. And, you know, I didn't manage to get that 680 or 690 Rand, but there was a lot of buying in the low 700s. And that was also a phenomenal opportunity. If you consider that, I mean, that was 2020 and Capitec is sitting at about 2,500, 2,600 now. But in retrospect, you go back to 2014, and had I appropriately thought about, let's say, the lower cost in this business, how aggressive the business had been in gaining market share, and how they just caught the big four banks sleeping when it came to the retail market. I mean, the stock was not expensive if you appropriately allowed for the revenue growth that they would have generated. So very, very lucky that there were two more opportunities to buy.
I must say, I have great respect for somebody who trusts their own valuation model so shortly after such a damning report. The Viceroy report was really an interesting one and really negative about Capitec. But also, if you want to invest in banks, normally you would go and look at the cheapest banks. And even with decline we saw in the share price of Capitec at the time, it was still the most expensive bank. It has been the most expensive bank for close to two decades. So why Capitec over maybe one of the others?
Return on equity. So if you look at the banks over the last couple of years, it's basically only been Capitec and FirstRand that have been generating returns on equity in excess of their cost of equity. So the other banks have effectively been destroying shareholder value. Standard Bank has gotten close, and they might be above their cost of equity right now. But, you know, it's debatable. But, you know, Nedbank and Absa were nowhere close. So you argue that these things are cheap. You know, people look at these businesses and they go, hey, FirstRand's on a 2x price to book, and you can buy another bank on 1.2 or 1x price to book. But if the return on equity is below the cost of equity, you've got to pay less than 1x book. So people just look at the PE multiple and say it's cheap, but it's actually not. You're buying an incredibly expensive business. And I think Capitec on the retail banking side at the time was generating a return on equity, I think, in the mid-40s, if I'm mistaken. Maybe I'm mistaken, but it might have been low-40s, but I think it was mid-40s. So relative to the valuation, all of a sudden, you know, if you look back, you go, actually, it's not that expensive. But remember, the mistake I made was thinking exactly that. It was expensive. You just don't have a sense of the growth. Now, I didn't by any means say, okay, you're putting 20, 30, 40% of your portfolio into this. It was a much smaller component of the portfolio. But yeah, it's been the most successful investment I've made so far.
A very, very actuarial way of looking at investments. And I think it's a good lesson. You know, you don't only look at PEs, look at other metrics as well. And you should formulate a collective type of investment opinion about a particular investment. But Sumesh, we'll have to leave it there. We've run out of time. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ray.
That was Sumesh Chetty. He is a portfolio manager at 91.
Show me the money.
That was the Money Web, the A Better Investor podcast with Rake Finikap. Thanks for listening. Catch up and listen to all the Money Web podcasts on moneyweb.co.za or the app. Money Web, your trusted source for business and investment insights.